vast majority of this year C of the lectionary cycle are Sunday Gospel and taken from the Gospel of St. Luke. All of the Gospels are great, all four. But each one has its own gifts. And in the year of Luke, we're privy to a few of the great gifts that Luke has. He's a great writer. In Greek, he had the most facility of any of the Gospel writers. So when we read him, when we listen to him, the narrative unflows. It flows very easily, very beautifully. And he also happens to be a great storyteller. All the Gospel writers tell great stories. But when we read Luke's stories, in just a few verses, he paints a world that's very vivid. And we know that we're in the presence of a master, really, when it comes to telling a story. So we might ask ourselves then, what is it that makes a great story? We could answer this question a little bit differently. Certainly we know that Christ, the great storyteller, again and again in the Gospels, he's offering a story to his listeners. One of the qualities of a great story we hear is a certain sense of timelessness. It doesn't tend to age very quickly. This is certainly the case with the parable of the prodigal son in chapter 15 that we just heard. The day that Christ utters this parable, it spoke brilliantly, beautifully, to the minds and hearts of his listeners. And the same is true today. It's no less relevant to us than it was when Christ uttered it. It ages well because in a way it doesn't age at all. This story appears to be something of an eternal one. And on the last day of creation of humanity, this story will still have a great meaning in speaking to our lives. So it's timeless, one of the great qualities of the story. Another quality that a great story has, we can answer this question differently, but it tends to have a way of inviting us into the life of the characters. They're knowable people. We feel like maybe we've even met them before. And this is another great quality of the prodigal son. We picture these people, and I think in a sense, as we age, we start to have insights into the three main characters a little bit more. So I want to say a few words tonight about the three main characters. And to begin with the son who sets this whole narrative in motion, asking for his father's inheritance. It's as if he says to his father, "Let's pretend that you're dead." We don't know if he knew the full implication of what he was saying, but it's hard to think of a more devastating message for a child to give to a parent. And the son thinks that with this inheritance, his life will take off and will begin to increase. So he must have been astonished when he found out that the opposite happens. Not only does his life not increase, it begins to diminish. The farther he gets away from his father's house, the more life diminishes in him until the point that he's quite literally near death. And in that moment, there's a great literary detail that's offered. When this younger son is longing for the pies that the swine feed on, Luke's gospel tells us that no one gave him anything, which is a striking commentary on being cut off from God, being isolated from God, turning away from God. There is no giver. There's no giver, there's no gift when we experience being in isolation from God. So in a way, when the son returns, he's returning to giving, to the gift, to the giver. And along the way, the return back, doesn't this all resonate with us, the return to God? Along the way, life begins to increase in him, until the point that he experiences the fullness of life in being returned to the company of the Father. There's a little detail that we hear a little bit differently than Christ's audience would have heard in the first century. We all appreciate that the younger brother has been, in a sense, in a type of slavery and servitude. But Jesus' audience would have understood something very profound happening when the son returns to his father. Because the robe, the ring, and the sandals, they're more than just gifts. It's not just that the son is back in his father's house. These symbols, these status, just these things that one might accommodate, they connote a sense of being a free person. So if you have shoes for your feet, if you have a ring, a robe, a cloak, it means that you're a free servant. So it's not just that he's home, it's that he's a free person again. Which is another great commentary on the way out of the world. One of the great human temptations is to pursue freedom independent from God. To think that we can arrive at a sense of freedom on our own, by our own merits. We see this from the very beginning of the Hebrew Scriptures with Adam and Eve. What Luke and Christ are trying to point out to us is that freedom is only arrived at in the presence of God. We can't do this on our own. We only arrive in a sense, the fullness of freedom, with God's help. It's a powerful commentary on our world. And there's a wonderful commentary on reconciliation, too, in this part of the gospel. Because the Father says to the servants, put these items on the man. The Son doesn't come back to take them for himself. A powerful commentary on forgiveness, because when we sin, we offend another person, but we also offend God. We owe it to God, to another person, to be forgiven on their terms, not on ours. We have to receive these gifts for what they are, as gifts of God. The older son, a fascinating figure too, one of the things I think that might surprise him is that he's actually very much, in some ways, like his younger brother. He too chooses exile, to be isolated. The father has to go out to meet both of his sons. Reminds me in a way of a line that I heard when I was still in seminary in Baltimore. I was at an inner city parish, and wasn't yet a priest, but was still a traditional deacon. And I remember the priest was preaching about one of these gospel passages where Christ breaks bread with sinners. And he said, breaking the bread with sinners, what's that like? He kind of asked this hypothetical question to the congregation. Breaking bread with sinners, what's that like? And then he said, stick around a few minutes and you'll find out. This is what happens really in every Mass. We're breaking bread with sinners. Why is this so important? Well, the Son in a way is a reminder of the scribes and Pharisees at the beginning of the Gospel. They're critiquing Christ for this very thing, welcoming sinners, breaking bread with them. One way to think about this, the importance of breaking bread with sinners, is to think of this cathedral community. One of the great parts about worshiping here is that we've got a very diverse audience. Every weekend, we have many people who are traveling, different states, different countries. Even people who are members of this parish don't all live in this neighborhood. In fact, hardly anybody does. They come from many different counties, towns, different states, different counties in Indiana. We also have a number of immigrants here, people who are from different countries, thankfully. They remind us of the universality of the church. So what do we all have in common coming here to worship? It's not that we're Catholics, because very often there are people who are not Catholic who come to Mass because they like the space, and they're certainly welcome to come. It's a good thing that they're here. It's not even that we're all believers, that we all have a gift of faith. I've talked to plenty of people over the years, the priests come to church and they say, I'm not sure if I really believe in God. I'm trying to figure this out. Some even say, I don't, but I like the congregation. I like the sense of community. So what is it then that we all have in common? You can answer this different ways, but at least one of the things that we all have in common is that we're interested in conversion. Whether we're Catholic or not, whether we believe in God or not, every one of us, no matter how old, no matter how young, we're all in the midst of conversion. We're not who we once were. We're not yet who we will be. We're being transformed, renewed by the grace of God, and it's the work of a lifetime. That's why this meal of the Eucharist is so important, because it's food for people who are in the midst of conversion. We can't do it on our own. We have to have divine help to make this work. I was thinking about this yesterday in the confessional. What would the alternative be to breaking bread with sinners? To say, I'm not going to enter into it, I'm not going to break bread with sinners. What's the alternative? What's your only other option? I think you could say it would be to starve. If you're not willing to break bread with sinners, you're going to starve. Could you even eat with yourself? No. Ultimately, we have to. We have to break bread with sinners. That's why this gathering, what we do right now, is so important to us. Which brings us, in a way, to the Father. I think as we age, hopefully we appreciate the Father more. We want Him to be a part of our lives. We use the word prodigal to speak of the son, the youngest son. And it's a word we don't use in English a lot. Prodigal means lavish or extravagant. But it's a word, it's maybe a secret of the parable that best describes the Father. Because the Father is prodigal with Himself. He's lavish, extravagant with His gifts, with His home, with His self, with His time, with His energy. And this is always the case with God. Ultimately, God is prodigal, is lavish, extravagant, is creating the world, coming among us in an incarnation, dying for us on the cross. and rising from the dead, inviting us into eternal life. God is always prodigal, lavish with us. One of the things I really like that stood out to me in thinking of the prodigal son this weekend is that the Father is supremely interpersonal, supremely relational. And I think this is most on display at the end when he's talking to the oldest son. This oldest son is upset, and when he speaks to his father, of his brother, he doesn't say, "My brother." He says, "Your son." That's not good. That's bad. If think of being a child, you get home from school, it's never a good thing if you heard your mom say to your father, and you weren't supposed to hear this, "Did you hear what your son, your daughter, did at school today?" Never a good thing. You know it's going to be a rough night. You just got to say your prayers. It's not a good way to start. Your son did this. It was kind of fascinating how the father responds to this situation. It's pretty brilliant how he responds to his son. His first words are, "My son," speaking to the eldest. He's not going to get into an argument. He's not going to fight with him. "My son." A beautifully relational expression from the father to the eldest. And then when it's time to speak about the youngest, he doesn't call the youngest "my son." He says, "Your brother." As if to say, he may be a scoundrel, he shouldn't have done it, but he's still your brother. Your brother. Very relational. And in a way, it's very subtle, but he's correcting his oldest son to say, "Don't quite have it right." Deeply relational with his son. We heard the extended version of the gospel tonight, so it gives us these three parables back to back. You don't have to do it that way, but I think they play together very well to hear them side by side by side. Also, because when I was in seminary, there was a scripture scholar who said to us as future priests, "If you ever opt for the shorter version, I'll track you down and throw something at you." So, why was that? I'm a lot bigger than him, but we don't want to cause any trouble. But they're beautiful, side by side by side. When we hear them, we pick up on some common themes. The items that are lost are not the only one of their kind. There are other coins, there are other sheep, there's another son. But part of what's beautiful about these three parables is that the finder, in finding what is lost, treats it as if it's the only one. And in God's case, this happens not at the expense of the others. For God is possible to treat all of his creatures, all of his people, with complete, real presence, truly undivided attention. And part of what the parable invites us to is that as often as we're able, we should try to treat God the same.